getting down there.
Okay, so Clipper, is it going to happen? And if so, when? I mean, when are they going to fly this thing? I'm sure you can't wait.
Yeah, I really want to see Europa again before I retire. And I used to sort of say that as a joke, and now it's becoming, you know, something that actually has some meaning to it. I've been waiting for 15 years, Seth, for this mission, and we're closer than we've ever been before. And so we're ready. Basically, it needs the funding.
And so what's the status? I mean, the NASA budget is, well, I don't know, it's been treated better than people had expected.
Yeah, I would say that it's like so close that I could almost taste it. So this summer, there's a couple of calls for information that NASA is putting out. So the Clipper mission comes in at a budget level that's pretty good, but it's still expensive. It's a flagship level mission, which is the highest, most complex types of missions that NASA does.
That's what, about $1 billion?
Yeah, this is actually about $2 billion. And so basically, NASA has issued a challenge to the planetary science community to say, well, look, we can do this really, really great mission, this Europa Clipper, but let's see if you can cut it in half. What kind of a mission can you do for only $1 billion? And so there's a call for information out to the community this summer for places like universities or companies to go through and see if they can actually design a Europa mission that meets the majority of the major science goals for only $1 billion. And so we'll see. It's a great challenge.
Well, I gotta ask you the obvious. I mean, if there is life on Europa, it's underneath all that ice. And, you know, that ice is darn thick. It's miles and miles thick. It's going to be really dark down there. No photosynthesis. You know, how do I feed myself if I'm a bit of life under the ice of Europa?
That's actually a problem, right? So almost all life here on Earth depends on photosynthesis. So either directly, so it's, you know, it's soaking up that sunlight and converting it into energy and powering whole ecosystem, or it's eating something that was powered by photosynthesis. But there is life on Earth, like, you know, microbes that live inside rocks, for example, that basically they don't use photosynthesis at all. What they use is just chemical energy from the rock itself. So it is possible for life to exist without the sun. Certainly on Europa, what we think is that a possibility is that you could have life, say, down at the bottom of this ocean layer. If you have something similar to the hydrothermal systems here on Earth, if you have eruptions of, say, like, you know, warm material coming out of that base of that rock layer, coming up with all sorts of interesting, you know, chemical fluids and stuff in there, maybe that would be tasty for life.
Sounds like that the bottom line is there may be life there, but we shouldn't expect, you know, tuna or sharks or anything too big, because the food supply is somewhat constricted.
Yeah, probably not. And again, I would love to find giant squid or something like that in Europa. It'd be really cool. Or, you know, glowing octopuses like in Europa Report or something like that. It'd be fabulous. And the thing is, we can't rule it out. But if you just look at the amount of energy that we think is available for life on Europa, probably we're looking at microbes. Probably there just isn't enough energy to sustain anything really big. But we've been surprised before.
Cynthia Phillips, it's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Seth.
Cynthia Phillips is a planetary geologist at the SETI Institute.
Well, lots of exciting science. More than a half dozen habitats that we know about already in our own backyard, our own solar system.
And these promising leads, according to the scientists, require follow-up missions.
Yes, but you got to find the money.
You testified before Congress, Seth. What sort of support did you sense that Congress was giving toward science in general, astrobiology in particular?
Well, my impression is that they find it interesting and therefore possibly worthwhile. I mean, this requires new money, but it sounded like they were paying attention.
But that doesn't mean that they'll necessarily fund it. And just remind us of the NASA numbers, can you?
Yes. Well, funding is a different matter, of course. That's politics, always unpredictable. But the total NASA budget is about $17 billion. But of that, really, less than one-third goes toward basic scientific research.
Okay, less than one-third.
Yeah, so maybe $5 billion.
Although $5 billion seems like a lot of money.
Yeah, but the thing is that most of that budget's already committed to existing ongoing projects that are sucking up the majority of it. The wiggle room for new initiatives is always small in everybody's budget.
Okay, so the budgetary dilemmas continue. Well, thanks to a production team that never presents us with a dilemma and always gives us hope, Gary Niederhoff, Barbara Vance, and Molly Charlock.
Also support from Google, Rena Shulsky, David and Sammy David, and the NASA Astrobiology Institute. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, and a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to a new hope for life in space. You can find more Big Picture Science on iTunes and through the link on our website, where you will also find a link to other shows on astrobiology. And while you're online, you might find and even download our Big Picture Science app. It's on iTunes, Android, and Windows 8.
And if you're a podcast listener, but you prefer over-the-air radio because you just like the way broadcasts can drill through the atmosphere, well, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, consider letting them know you like the show. Oh, and do you have a comment, a criticism, a suggestion? Well, write us at bigpicturescience@seti.org. We'll definitely get back to you. We also go for flattery.
We come in peace. We come in peace. We come in peace.
We come in peace. The grizzly bear is an iconic symbol of the American West. As many as 50,000 once roamed the western half of the United States, south of Canada. Today, their numbers have dwindled to about 1,600, isolated in the northern Rocky Mountains. For grizzlies to survive, they must be able to travel safely between large blocks of habitat. But the crucial pathways connecting these areas are being lost to development. The Vital Ground Foundation is working to ensure the future of the majestic grizzly by conserving strategically located wildlife habitat. By protecting land in exactly the right places, Vital Ground doesn't need to save thousands of acres, just the hundreds of acres that provide the greatest impact. To find out how you can help, visit www.vitalground.org. Where the grizzly can walk, the earth is healthy and whole.
This is Dr. Wally B. from Cat Daddy in the 1320s, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn, making waves.
The following is an encore presentation of Sierra Club Radio.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. For our Earth Day special, we're thrilled to talk with the legendary Dr. Jane Goodall, primatologist, anthropologist, and considered to be the world's foremost expert on chimpanzees. Known for her 45-year study of wild chimpanzees in Tanzania, she's also the founder of the Jane Goodall Institute and the Roots and Shoots program, and a leader in conservation. She joins us today to talk about her new book, Seeds of Hope, Wisdom and Wonder from the World of Plants. Welcome.
Well, thank you.
We were thrilled to see the new book. It's fantastic. And you're known for decades of work on primates. And we're wondering why the focus now is shifting to plants.
Well, first of all, you know, I shifted away from just primates because of the state of the environment and the number of species facing extinction and the destruction of whole ecosystems. And that led to my writing the previous book, which was Hope for Animals and Their World. And initially, there was a whole section in that book on plants, rescuing plants from extinction. And the publisher said, well, sorry, but this is much too long. Because we had to cut nearly all the plant stuff out. And I felt really bad for all the botanists who'd helped so much, you know. And so I thought, well, pull the stuff I've done together, we'll make a little slim volume. Maybe it'll sell in botanical gardens. But it was literally as though the plants put roots into my brain and said, Jane, you've been helping animals all your life. It's our time now. And so the book took on a completely different shape as I wrote it. It evolved all the time to include more and more different aspects.
What did you find most surprising when you were researching this book?
Oh, I just love it about trees communicating either with chemical-like substances. When caterpillars attack them, they put these signals out, and other trees of that species receive the signals, and that causes them to make extra toxins in their leaves to repel, an invasion of the same species of insect. And they can also communicate with their roots way down under the ground through little thread-like fungus. And I just find this absolutely fascinating. And also the sheer diversity of plant life and the climates they adapt to and the, you know, the ways that they evolve to become pollinated and to reproduce. It's just utterly fascinating.
I've also read that you've become very vocal about your opposition to genetically modified organisms. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, when I first heard of them, and that's going way back when, I don't even remember when I first heard of what in Europe we called Frankenfoods, they were called. And it seemed to me a violation of life to stick genes from another species. And, of course, more recently I've learned a lot about the process from talking to, particularly to people who were working within the industry and left it. And, you know, the thing that emerges is that although the proponents will claim that the science is exact, it's not. And it can have unintended side effects. So in addition to that, once you get these modified plants, genetically modified plants, out in the environment, then, of course, through pollination and wind, this can spread, and that can be very dangerous for the environment.
You famously started your work working with chimpanzees, and you're now working, obviously, to talk about plants and genetically modified organisms. And I'm wondering how your dreams and hopes for the future have changed since you began your work.
When I began the work in 1960 with the chimps, we didn't talk about conservation. There wasn't a need for it back then, at least it wasn't generally perceived, because the forest belt where the chimps live stretched right across Africa. We called it the Equatorial Forest Belt. And it wasn't until the mid-80s that I realized that, goodness, these forests are disappearing. The foreign logging companies have come in. Roads are being made deep into the forest by the loggers and the mining companies. This enables the forest to be opened up to the hunters. The hunters are going in and shooting everything in the illegal commercial bushmeat trade. And, you know, everything that I loved was endangered and threatened. And that's why I left my paradise of Gombe and the idyllic life I was leading, you know, learning about the chimpanzees, time to do some teaching at Stanford, analyzing the data that I loved, writing the odd book, building up a research station. I mean, it was all that I dreamed of as a child and more. But realizing what was going on in the world around, I felt that I had to do my little bit to try and help.
Do you still travel back to Tanzania to visit the original site of your research and the chimpanzees there?
Oh, twice a year I get to Gombe. It's only for a few days, but it serves to renew my spirit to be out in the forest that I love so much. And but, you know, we have, the Jane Goodall Institute has projects in 5 African countries, and this a major part of that is working to improve the lives of the people living in poverty around the wilderness areas, and eventually they become our partners and help us in conservation, and that's going to be the saving of the chimpanzees and other creatures that live in the forests.
How endangered are chimpanzees today?
Well, they were between 1 and 2 million 100 years ago, and today probably the very most is 300,000, but they're spread over 21 different countries, many of them in tiny isolated groups like Gombe, where unless we can create corridors linking them to other groups, you know, they'll become, the population won't be viable because of inbreeding. So there's an awful lot of work to be done, and chimps are still disappearing quite fast.
When you travel back to Gombe to spend some time with the chimpanzees there, do you find that you still have a connection with individuals in the chimpanzee community there? Are there ones that you still recognize and know, even if you're only there twice a year?
Just a few, but they're going fast. You know, we're losing some of the ones that I held dearest. We lost Fifi's 2 eldest sons, actually not to old age, but to some kind of illness very, very recently. There's just about 3 that I really know now, that's all.
How do they react when they see you after such a long absence? Do you have the sense that they remember you and know you and miss you when you're gone?
Oh, they definitely know me, absolutely. But they, you know, the way it is there is that they trust everybody. So they're not going to treat me any differently, really.
What did your time living with the chimpanzees in Gombe teach you about people?
Taught me that we are so similar. The chimpanzees are closest relatives. There's clearly not a sharp line dividing us from the rest of the animal kingdom. That we're not the only beings with personalities, minds, and feelings, above all feelings. And that gives you pause when you start thinking about the ways we treat and abuse so many other creatures. You know, there's a big bit in the book about the importance of eating less meat, because people don't even think about this, but huge areas of forest are cut down every year to feed, you know, to grow the grain, to feed the billions of farm animals in these awful intensive farms. And of course, that's leading, you know, adding to the greenhouse gases, which is accelerating climate change. And all these billions of animals are creating a lot of methane gas as a result of their digestive system. And that's adding to the greenhouse gas. It's more virulent than, even than CO2. And the antibiotics used to keep the poor creatures alive are getting into the environment, and bacteria are building up resistance so that people have died from a cut finger because they can't find a strong enough antibiotic. So, you know, whichever way you look at it, this growing demand for more and more cheap meat is horrific.
What do you think is the biggest or most effective change that we could make for the survival of our species and also of other species?
Changed attitude. You know, this is why I work so hard on our youth program, Roots and Shoots, because if we can just spend a little bit of time thinking about the consequences of the small choices we make each day, what we eat, what we buy, where does it come from, did it cause environmental or social harm, etc., etc., people begin making more ethical choices in their lives. Children can affect their parents and grandparents. And I don't think we have too long a window of time to start slowing down climate change and ecosystem destruction. And this is why I travel 300 days a year, to get this message around, that there is hope, but we've got to change attitudes, and we've got to change faster, and we've got to change attitudes of big business, and we've got to stop thinking that only the bottom line is what matters. It's not true.
I heard that you recently turned 80 years old on April 3rd, so I wanted to wish you a happy belated birthday.
Well, thank you very much.
And I'm just so impressed and amazed that you're traveling 300 days a year. How do you find the energy for that? What keeps you going?
Well, for one, you know, we've got our Roots and Shoots program now in 136 countries. From preschool through university, even with adults forming groups. We've got approximately 150,000 active groups, and a group can be a whole school. And everywhere they've got, you know, wanting to tell Dr. Jane what they've been doing to make this a better world. One project to help people, one to help animals, one to help the environment that we all share, and also learning to live in peace and harmony with each other and with the natural world. So seeing that program grow gives me energy. Meeting the people who, you know, who won't give up, who tackle seemingly impossible tasks and succeed, or at least, you know, inspire others to carry on so that success will come for a good idea in the end.
What message do you have to share with today's young people?
That every single one of us matters in the big scheme of things. That every single one of us makes a difference every single day. And that's what so many people don't seem to understand. And so they look at the problems around the world, and they're so huge and so massive. What can I do about it? I'm just me. And so you've become apathetic. You do nothing. So that's why it's so important for people to realize that what as an individual you do does matter, because it's not just you, because ultimately billions of people will be making those ethical decisions in how they live their lives.
You've lived a truly remarkable life, you know, 80 years of not just cutting-edge research and changing the whole field of primatology and anthropology, but also all of your conservation work, your travels, your advocacy. When you look back on your life, what are some of the memories that you really hold most dear to you?
Well, I have very vivid memories of my childhood, growing up in England, in the war, with this wonderful garden and the beech tree, who's still there now, and up whose branches I've spent so much time. That's you know, a very vivid memory. The first time a chimpanzee stopped running away and let me approach and sit down quietly near him, that was the one I named David Greybeard. The first time a mother and her newborn baby, enabled me to properly see what was going on. That was Flo and little Flint. Those are very vivid memories. And I have such vivid memories, too, of my childhood teacher. That was my dog, Rusty.
What's next for you?
Next, carrying on with the same. I can't really change now, can I? But we want more Roots and Shoots groups in more countries, more young people inspired, young people inspiring their parents and their grandparents. And to see change in corporate mentality, it's beginning to happen. It has to happen faster.
Going back to your book, it seems sometimes that it's easier to motivate people to protect animals who they can identify with or who they think are cute. And when it comes time to conserve important plant species, it seems harder to motivate people around why that's so critical. What do you say to that?
Well, I don't know that it's so different to protect a plant species or a endangered species of spider, for example. It's the cute, furry things that you can motivate people most easily. But, you know, one of the goals of Roots and Shoots is to get children at a young age out into nature, even if it's plants that come into the inner city, into the classroom, so that they can see the wonder of a plant putting out its little roots and growing up and curling around obstacles and reaching the light. It's very magical. And I think, you know, we try desperately to get children out into the real, you know, nature, because that's important for their psychological development. So I think the more they know about plants and things as children, the more people will be prepared to help save them. And there is a big movement now. I mean, more and more gardens are being turned into, you know, indigenous habitat gardens for the indigenous species. The urban gorillas who are throwing packets of seeds around to make plants grow in the city areas. And urban farming, so that it's free from pesticide. Schools having they farm their own vegetables or they grow their own vegetables. So there is a movement back towards nature.
Well, it's truly been an honor to have the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm wondering if you have any other words you'd like to share with our listeners.
Just that. You know, one of the things that I think people will be amazed by in this book is how all of this interrelates and all of the fascinating things that I didn't know about and most people don't know about the early plant hunters who risked their lives and sometimes lost them going into the most, you know, inaccessible places back in the 17th century to find plants, which now we know from our gardens. And all the amazing people fighting to conserve the forest, fighting to conserve different environments. All of this is very inspiring to me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us on our show today. For our listeners, you've been listening to Dr. Jane Goodall. Her latest book is Seeds of Hope, Wisdom and Wonder from the World of Plants. A little over a decade ago, renowned architect William McDonough partnered with Michael Braungart to write a book called Cradle to Cradle, and it has become a seminal manifesto of green design. His new book is being published, The Upcycle, Beyond Sustainability, Designing for Abundance, and he's here to talk with us about it today. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, it's great to have you on the show. We're really honored to have you on as our guest. And I wanted to start by talking about the title. What does it mean to upcycle?
Well, it can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. But we'd like to look at it as a quality question. And in Cradle to Cradle, we talked about the fact that most things that we call recycled today are actually downcycled. They're losing quality. If you mix all sorts of stuff together and make a park bench, it's an amalgam of food-grade plastics that have become sort of a hybrid on their way to a landfill or incinerator. So in Cradle to Cradle, we talked about upcycling as something like taking back a water bottle and improving its quality as we put it back into the world of plastics for the future generations. So that would just be plastics. But we see the same thing for the biosphere. You know, wouldn't it be great if things that would come back, instead of being recycled, but they were toxic to begin with, like PVC things or lead-containing things, end up in the biosphere. If we could actually clean them up if they come back and put them back into endless resourcefulness, safe and healthy. It's improving the quality, and it works the same in life, and we can recycle things for biology, recycle things for technology, and also see it all as food and make it food for thought.
I think sometimes people have this perception that green design or green solutions are sparse, that they think going green might mean giving up that feeling of abundance. And yet you write about designing for abundance. What does that mean for you?
If we look at the issue of sustainability per se, and I asked you what's your relationship to your family or your spouse, and you said sustainable, I'd say I'm sorry. So the idea that we have a system that is destructive and we want to sustain it, or we talk about zero as a goal, it's as if we're just bad and we're trying to be less bad, but we're not saying what our goal is. And a zero means it's better if we're not here. So wouldn't it be nice if it was good if we were here? Well, that would mean we'd have a positive instead of a negative footprint. And that would mean we could honor the natural systems, which celebrate growth. So just to talk about things that are less bad is fine because it's reducing the demand on the environment of negative things. But really, we could talk about more good. And when we do that, we realize that nature uses solar energy to fuel biota, building soil. And carbon comes from the atmosphere into soil. That's the design. And things grow. And that's really the model, I think, for human productivity for the next century.
What are some examples of how we can apply that model?
Well, I do it in buildings since I'm trained as an architect. And I was asked by NASA to do their Mars station in part because they wanted to integrate our thinking into that project. And we decided in the end to do an Earth station first and then have a building like a tree on Earth. Imagine if you were an astronaut landing on Earth and you had all the experience from the space program. What would you do? If you looked around and said, I need energy, you wouldn't start digging holes looking for fossil fuels, and you wouldn't start building nuclear plants. You would look at the sun. It rises every morning, sets every evening. You say, oh, look, we have a nuclear reactor within easy reach, 93 million miles away. It's 8 minutes, and it's wireless. Let's go. And that's what NASA had done in space. They invented the photovoltaic. So if you stop and think about it, people say you don't need to be a rocket scientist to do something terrestrially. But what if we were? And then you realize that we've thought about all kinds of things that can work on the Earth and be like trees that are fecund, that grow things. So the building we've designed there has the potential to produce 120% of the energy it might need from renewable sources. And it honors the human intelligence, and it honors humility, because it did take us 5,000 years to put wheels on our luggage. In the meantime, we also went to the moon. So what if we put those together and with humility design buildings that can make, you know, renewable power into a source greater than that we need so we can share it?
In the book, you talk about speaking to the world in positives. And I really love that you have a chapter titled, Houston, We Have a Solution.
We did that when we started the NASA Space Station project because I asked that the first meeting of our design team be in the room where they heard the words, you know, effectively, Houston, we have a problem. And so the idea that we'd take on a positive attitude and start moving that way is so much more interesting to me than just saying, woe is us, let's try to be less bad.
In the book, you also say that we don't have an energy problem. We have what you call a materials in the wrong place problem. Tell us a little bit more about that.
When people say we have an energy problem, therefore we have to drill, baby, drill, I think we're missing the fundamental point from a scientific perspective as well as from a design perspective. We don't have an energy problem. We have lots of energy. It's actually mostly ancient solar income, or it's energy from various materials. But one of them is carbon. And over the millennia and the millions of years, even billions of years, we have seen carbon accrue to soil, and then it gets buried and pressurized, and we get hydrocarbons. But if we stop and think about it, we have a material problem. We have carbon, a material, in the atmosphere where it's a toxin. A material is in the wrong place is a toxin. Lead in your baby's mouth is a neurotoxin. Lead in the computer or the telephone or the radio you're listening to is solder. If we release that into the biosphere, it becomes a neurotoxin because it's in the wrong place. So we have to be really careful to keep toxins in their place, away from biology in this case. And in the case of carbon, we love carbon. We are carbon. Trees are carbon. So what happened? We put it in the atmosphere where it really wasn't designed to be put. It was designed to be accrued in soil. And so that's the issue. We have plenty of energy. It's just that it's carbon-based. And then we're putting the carbon back into the atmosphere at parts per million that are problematic. So it's become a toxin. But that's because we did that. You know, you think about a tool. A tool doesn't know about its value. So when we say let's be less bad and reduce our carbon, less and bad are not numbers that multiply as negatives to a positive, because less is a relationship and bad is a human value. So you're bad, just less so. So if we only say we're going to reduce our carbon emissions as our goal, then it's we're going towards zero. Well, that's nice, but you just told me what we're not going to do. You told me what to do. And so just getting less bad is not being good. And that's why we look at carbon and say, isn't it wonderful? We are carbon. Isn't carbon going to the soil wonderful? Aren't things growing wonderful? And things that destroy that are not. So that's why we say we don't have an energy problem. We have a material problem.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
Just that I think that, you know, I'm so honored to be talking to the Sierra Club, because if you look at the Sierra Club as a way of looking at the world, it has always honored the environment as a fundamental fulcrum of all human behavior. And I think that's a critical place to understand. And so it's a privilege to be here.
Well, thanks so much. And it's been an honor talking with you today. You've been listening to William McDonough talk about his new book, The Upcycle, Beyond Sustainability, Designing for Abundance.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
HFC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology includes detailed instruction related to the various systems found on today's vehicles. This program is designed to provide students with a thorough knowledge of the technical aspects of the automobile and to develop a certain level of manual skill in servicing, testing, and diagnosing. Classroom and laboratory classes provide students with the experience and understanding they'll need to qualify in numerous fields of employment associated with the automobile industry. For more information on HFC's Associate Degree Program in Automotive Technology, contact instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350. That's instructor Gary Hines at 313-845-6350.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. On today's show, we'll talk with Congressman John Sarbanes about the issue of getting big money out of politics. We'll also hear from the Sierra Club's Marianne Hitt about a recent report on the dangers of coal ash and what you can do about it, and get some green living tips from Sierra Magazine's Avital Andrews. Joining us today over the phone is Congressman John Sarbanes. He's represented Maryland's 3rd District in the United States Congress since 2007. We're thrilled to talk with him today about the very important issue of money in politics and some of the work that he's done in that area. So thank you so much for joining us, Congressman.
Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure.
I wanted to start by talking a little bit about why some of our listeners who care about the environment should also care about getting big money out of politics. How do those two issues intersect, in your view?
Well, I'll tell you, when I go around my district, I encounter what I think is almost a national epidemic, which is there's a deep, deep cynicism out there on the part of everyday citizens in terms of whether their voice actually is being heard in Washington and in Congress. I think they look at big money's influence there and say, you know, how does our voice even get into the mix? And they're not wrong about that. I mean, there is a tremendous amount of influence wielded in Washington and in Congress by these big moneyed interests, many of whom, frankly, are getting in the way of important environmental progress that we would like to see. And so as I talk to people who are very active on the environment, want to see us make progress on climate change, want to see us move from fossil fuels to renewable energy and so forth, I see that cynicism in their voices too, that they want to make progress, but they feel like the oil and gas industry, the coal industry, the chemical industry is always going to overwhelm their voice in Washington. So the question is, what can we do about that to empower everyday citizens so their voice actually does make a difference and make people who are active on the environment and working hard feel like that's really going to make a difference?
How did this get to be a primary issue that you focus on?
From going around my district, talking to people, from seeing how things operate in Washington, I just began to feel like I couldn't do things the same old way. And I needed to explore an opportunity through legislation to create a different system for funding campaigns. The fact of the matter is that the average member of Congress, in order to win a competitive election every 2 years, has to raise about $1.6 million. Right now, if you want to raise that kind of money, there's only one place to go to do it, you know, from PACs and big money sources that can dispense it quickly and in large amounts. The effect of that is then when you get back in there, you have a certain dependency on those sources, and human nature suggests that the institution will start leaning in the direction of those interests when it comes to making public policy and away from what the broad public wants to see. So I thought, let's see if we can create a different system, a system that would allow candidates and members of Congress to choose to raise their dollars from small donors and earn matching funds and be viable as candidates and competitive as candidates without having to go to those traditional big money sources. And the Government by the People Act, which is what we've introduced and the Sierra Club and a number of other environmental organizations have endorsed, I think would create a system that would begin to turn candidates back towards everyday citizens and begin listening to the broad public out there instead of being so dependent on big moneyed interests.
I'm curious to hear some examples from you of how you've seen the influence of big money affect your daily work in Congress.
I used to sit on the Natural Resources Committee. I sit on the Energy and Commerce Committee. That's a place where we, from time to time, have the occasion to examine and consider some of these tremendous taxpayer subsidies that are going to the oil and gas industry. Almost $5 billion a year in taxpayer money that's subsidizing an industry which, frankly, in 2011 posted profits of over $100 billion in that 1 year. And so I got very interested in why can't we get those loopholes closed? Why can't we eliminate those subsidies? And as you begin to study it, you realize and you discover that that industry, just to pick that particular example, is contributing millions of dollars every election cycle to congressional campaigns. They're also deploying armies of lobbyists on Capitol Hill to maintain those loopholes that they have. So it's very difficult when Congress has this dependency on that particular industry to get that loophole closed. If we could close that loophole, we could take those dollars, we could redirect them to supporting clean energy initiatives, for example, across the country. And so that was a very specific example where you see certain entrenched industries with a lot of influence who frankly don't have the kind of commitment to advancing an environmental agenda that groups like the Sierra Club do. We're standing in the way of progress, and we're having undue influence. And I think that if we could create a different system for raising money for campaigns, for funding congressional campaigns, that broke that dependency that so many candidates and members have on that particular industry, you begin to see environmental policy accelerate in a very positive way. And so that's just one potential promise of getting a system in place like the one that the Governed by the People Act would create.
Sometimes this can seem like a beltway problem with a government that people don't have faith in. How is this also affecting things for people specifically in districts around the country, not in D.C.?
First and foremost, I think the feeling that Washington has been sort of bought and sold by special interests just contributes to this increasing sense of cynicism and disconnection on the part of the average person out there. And so you see people kind of fleeing the political town square because they feel like their voice doesn't matter. When that happens, people begin to kind of pull up stakes from community engagement and citizen engagement and civic engagement. Then I think you're on a path, you're really on a path to where you have to begin worrying about the democracy. I mean, in some sense, the influence of big money on our politics is an existential crisis for the democracy, because if people divest of any interest in politics and government and community because they think their voice isn't really being heard, then, you know, you begin to kind of spiral downward. So I sense it when I talk to everyday citizens in this kind of feeling, this kind of defeated feeling and sort of apathy about whether they can actually make a difference. Now, to their credit, oftentimes they'll turn into their own communities. They'll try and do things through volunteerism and service that make a difference, and it does make a difference. But sure, it would be nice to feel like government and Washington and Congress was your partner in that effort instead of working against you. And that's why I think it's so important that we create a new system that not only allows candidates to break their dependency on big money and make better public policy, but also has the effect of empowering the small donors, the everyday citizens out there who feel like their voice deserves to be heard in their own democracy rather than having their voice constantly pushed on to the sidelines of the democracy. And so what I've discovered, whether it's the environment, whether it's issues of civil rights, whether it's issues of working families, whatever issue somebody cares about, it's pretty easy to connect the dots to how big money in Washington is kind of blocking the path of progress on those issues. And so if you talk to people about what they care about most deeply, and then you kind of raise their awareness of how the influence of big money is getting in the way of that, then you begin to build support for change and support for legislation like the Government by the People Act. And I think that's one of the reasons, frankly, we're seeing such broad grassroots support from organizations like the Sierra Club, the NAACP, CWA, other groups that in the past might not have embraced campaign reform as an important issue because they had other substantive things they needed to focus on. But they understand now that if they want the issue they care about to be advanced, they've also got to deal with this influence of big money. And so they're kind of the cavalry. They're coming in and getting behind this effort across the country to build momentum for this kind of reform. And I think that's in some ways the most exciting and game-changing dimension of what we're seeing right now.
And especially for our listeners, I mean, for Sierra Club Radio, I'm wondering, you know, if you have thoughts on the prospects for a strong climate bill or lands protections, clean air legislation, that type of work, and how the prospects for their success would be higher with reforms to get money out of politics.
There is absolutely no question that making progress on climate change, on transitioning our energy portfolio from fossil fuels to clean energy sources, to protecting public lands. I mean, you can run up and down the list of things that the environmental community cares about. There's no question in my mind that if we could create a different system for funding campaigns that put everyday citizens back in the middle, right, instead of standing on the sidelines, that you would start to see a change in public policy in Washington that would advance all of those environmental positions. The fact of the matter is, the ugly truth is that industries like the oil and gas industry and the coal industry and the chemical industry, who frankly don't have that same commitment to the issues I just mentioned that are of real concern to the environmental community, they've got a lot of money to pour into campaigns and into lobbying expenditures in Washington, and they get results. The Sierra Club just released a report with Oil Change International, which shows the incredible return on investment that those big industries like coal and oil and gas are getting for the dollars that they're spending in Washington. It's something like a 5,900% return on investment. And I think the American people have to decide that they want to own their government. I mean, somebody's going to own this government. It's either going to be special interests and big money, or it's going to be the public. And the good thing is, if the public decides to step up and own it, then the public starts to see the return on investment. The public starts to see climate change legislation. The public begins to see investment in clean energy initiatives and in protecting our public lands and in improving and preserving clean water and clean air. That's the kind of agenda that we can advance, I think, significantly if we can transform the way campaigns are funded in Washington and in Congress. And that's the promise, the potential of the Government by the People Act. I don't want to pretend that it will solve all the world's ills. Nothing can. But in terms of beginning to connect everyday citizens to good public policy, where their representatives are truly answering to them and not being co-opted or thrown off course by big money, it would be a huge step in the right direction.
Last question for you. How can our listeners get involved and what can they do to help?
Great question. So the Sierra Club in particular has been terrific about pushing information on the Government by the People Act out to its membership and encouraging people to sign online petitions in support of the Government by the People Act. As a result of that, we have 40 organizations nationally that are encouraging people to sign petitions and become citizen co-sponsors, and we have over 400,000 people that have done that in the last 3 months, just in the last 3 months. So I would encourage all of your members, you know, go on record, indicate your support for the Government by the People Act, for this kind of change in how we fund campaigns to put the voices of everyday citizens over and above the voices of special interests and big money. And so you can go to the online platforms that the Sierra Club has, go to Sierra Club website and find your way to signing the petition in support of the Government by the People Act. You can Google that name, Government by the People Act, and you will find your way to any number of online petitions that are supporting it. And then reach out to your own member of Congress. I mean, Sierra Club is one of the best organized membership organizations around the environment in the country and has members in every single congressional district. And you ought to reach out to your member of Congress, whether they be Republican or Democrat, because frankly the polling shows that there's broad support across the political spectrum for this kind of reform. And specifically ask your member of Congress to support the Government by the People Act if they're not already doing so. The way we're going to make a difference this time, the way we're going to get reform like this through so it can really benefit our environment and advance good, strong public policy is because of grassroots momentum and support. And I can't say enough about how the Sierra Club has stepped up and made this a priority along with all of its other priorities. And I think it's that kind of commitment that will mean that when that window of opportunity to get legislation like this through and passed presents itself, we'll be ready to take advantage of it and make it happen.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Congressman John Sarbanes, who has represented Maryland's 3rd District in the U.S. Congress since 2007. Joining us now is Mary Ann Hitt, the director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Mary Ann, we wanted to talk with you today because we know the Sierra Club recently released this new report on some of the problems with toxic coal ash and wanted to get your take on it. First of all, you know, curious to hear from you, what is the news in this new report and why is coal ash such a big problem?
Well, we are releasing a new report called Dangerous Waters, America's Coal Ash Crisis. And in the report, we are highlighting some of the most dangerous sites in America where toxic coal ash is stored. We had a very big high-profile spill in North Carolina in February of this year that not only shed a light on the problem of coal ash there, but served as a reminder that we still have ticking time bombs like this all over the country. So we're using this report to really showcase and highlight some of those additional sites around the country that pose a real threat to people's safety and drinking water.
And for a lot of our listeners, they probably don't know what toxic coal ash is. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Indeed. When we burn coal in a power plant, there's this substance left behind called coal ash. That's a flowery substance, and it actually contains a lot of very dangerous pollutants like mercury, lead, arsenic, things that have been linked to human health problems, very dangerous chemicals you don't want to be exposed to. And as we've done a better job of pulling those pollutants out of the smokestacks and keeping them from going into the air, they're actually getting more and more concentrated in this coal ash that's left behind afterwards. The problem is we don't have any federal regulations in place for how that coal ash is disposed of. So at many coal plants, it's literally dumped into a hole in the ground. And many of these coal plants are located next to streams and rivers and lakes. So you end up with a recipe for exposing people to dangerous pollution and without the safeguards in place that are needed.
Tell us a little bit more about what happened in North Carolina for our folks who are listening who live in other parts of the country.
This February, there was a coal ash pond. Oftentimes, these things are stored in ponds where they're mixed with water at a retired coal plant owned by Duke Energy. Underneath that pond, there was an old storm drain that failed, and so this coal ash started gushing out into the Dan River, which flows from North Carolina into Virginia. It continued flowing for days until they were eventually able to stop it, and 70 miles of the river were coated up to 5 feet deep with this horrible toxic coal ash. So it was a public health emergency. It was a disaster for the local economies. And as a result, in North Carolina now, there's a lot of pressure to clean up. There are over a dozen of these coal ash sites just in that state alone, and there's a lot of pressure to clean those up. And it's providing some renewed momentum for efforts all around the country, from Illinois to Montana to New Mexico to Missouri, you name it. There are lots of places with these coal ash problems that remain a real threat to people's safety and drinking water and their health. And the North Carolina spill really underscored the urgency of, finally getting these federal regulations in place to just tell everybody how to safely dispose of this stuff, and then B, to clean up all of the sites that are out there that pose a threat to people.
Now, it's my understanding that other industries, when they have toxic waste to dispose of, they're already regulated in how they do that. You know, how long and why does the coal industry just get this free pass to not have to worry about their toxic pollution?
Well, unfortunately, the coal industry enjoys a lot of loopholes that other industries enjoy, whether it's mercury pollution into our air. They didn't have any federal standards in place for mercury pollution into the air from coal plants until very recently, and coal plants are our biggest source of mercury pollution into the air. We also don't have any federal standards in place for carbon pollution into the air from coal plants, and coal plants are the number one source of the carbon pollution that is disrupting and threatening our climate. So the coal industry has thrown their weight around for a long time and has enjoyed these loopholes that other industries have not enjoyed. And the same applies to coal ash. And EPA first took action after a very big coal ash spill in Tennessee back in 2008 that spilled a billion gallons of coal ash from a coal plant operated by the Tennessee Valley Authority. They are still cleaning up that spill all of these years later, and EPA started writing these new regulations at that point, but they got mired in opposition and red tape, and so now we are really pushing to get them over the finish line by December of this year.
And, you know, I've heard that there's, you know, a lot more coal ash around the country than people actually realize in terms of, you know, the volume of coal ash that is part of the waste stream. I mean, what does this mean for people who live in other places that aren't affected by the Dan River spill in North Carolina?
Well, there are over 1,000 of these coal ash sites all around the country. Just about every coal-fired power plant has been storing its coal ash on the site, again, oftentimes in what is really nothing more than a big hole in the ground. And so if you're downstream from that coal plant, depending on that body of water for your drinking water, if it's in a place that you like to fish or swim, if it's potentially even a dam, some of these dams that EPA has identified, if they fail, actually physically pose a threat to people's safety just from the, you know, the danger of being trapped in the water or the mud that would come spilling if the dam failed. So people really need to learn about where these sites are and figure out if they're in the vicinity of them, because believe it or not, people really oftentimes have no clue that they live next to one of these sites until something goes wrong.
What can our listeners do to help?
Well, if folks want to see the report, they can find it at sc.org/coal-ash-report. They can see the sites that we're highlighting as some of the most dangerous in the country. And they can also help us by sending in a comment to the EPA and encouraging them, when they finalize these coal ash regulations this December, that the standards are actually strong and they actually do the job of protecting our health and our safety.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
One last point of information. If you want to see an interactive map of all of the coal ash sites in the country that we've been able to identify, you can go to beyondcoal.org/water and zoom in on your state and check out the coal ash sites that are near you, because it's, again, there are a lot more of these sites than people realize, and the first step is to inform yourself, and then the second step is to get involved and help us get these sites cleaned up and get these long overdue federal standards in place.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Marianne Hitt, the director of the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign. Joining us now in our studio is Avital Andrews, the Green Living editor for Sierra Magazine. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Arlie.
So today we're going to talk about green car accessories.
Yeah.
And I know that can seem a little bit like an oxymoron, because obviously the greenest way to get around is to walk or to bike or even to take public transit. But we do know that some of our listeners out there do own cars. Mm-hmm. It's true. People do own them. Talk to us about some of your ideas for green car accessories from the latest issue of Sierra Magazine.
Yeah, that was a great lead. And there was actually even a little bit of controversy among editors about whether we should feature car accessories in an environmental magazine, because cars are so detrimental to the environment, and we know that many of our members would so much rather alternate means. But, you know, we did a survey and 97% of Sierra Club members own at least one car, and so we just presume that they drive it occasionally. So, you know, whether you're caring for an EV, a hybrid, we want to make sure that your car care products are responsible too, just like you are. So, you know, the first thing that I looked at was tires, because that's just the obvious thing you think of. I looked into a bunch of different brands, and the one that stood out to me as being the greenest is one from Yokohama. It's called the Avid Ascend. And the company claims that it saves more than 100 gallons of gas over its lifetime, which also saves 2,100 pounds of carbon dioxide from being emitted into the atmosphere, which is saying a lot given that this wheel goes 17,000 miles farther than most. So it also has a longer lifespan.
And what are some other tips for how to have greener accessories for your car?
Here's another thing to think about: motor oil. I mean, it's oil. So you would think that nothing could be more petrochemical than that. But and this is a fairly mainstream company, so I was surprised, but Valvoline actually has good options in both conventional oil and synthetic oil. Its product called Max Life Next Gen High Mileage Motor Oil. It's sort of a long name. But if you look at their Max Life line of products, a lot of them are, this particular one that we feature in the magazine is 50% recycled and double refined to extend the engine life and improve fuel efficiency, which makes you use less gas. And the fact that it's made from recycled oil, you know, already is clearly greener. And it's even made via a process that uses 90% less energy than making standard engine oil.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today and for sharing some of these tips for eco-friendly car accessories. And remember, the best accessory to be eco-friendly with a car is your bicycle.
Or your feet.
Or your feet, your sneakers. So thanks again. You've been listening to Avital Andrews, the Green Living Editor for Sierra Magazine.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
WHFR, Dearborn. Welcome to The Best of Broadway. I'm Joe, your host here on The Best of Broadway. We're coming to you from the beautiful campus of Henry Ford College in the world-class community of Dearborn, Michigan. Today we're going to have a play, which we've had before, but I'm going to tell you something a little bit about the background. About a month ago, I went to the Dearborn Symphony concert they had, and the last set was called the Polovtsian Dances by the Russian composer Alexander Borodin. And I was listening to this, and I kept, hey, I recognize that tune. And